Our guest is Cynthia Chung. She is a writer, author, and co-founder of the Rising Tide Foundation. You can find her on Substack as well, and she's also a writer for the Strategic Culture Foundation. Her latest book, which is really what I'm excited to talk about, is The Empire on Which the Black Sun Never Set, The Birth of International Fascism and Anglo-American Foreign Policy. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you for having me.
So I am really excited. I saw the video made on the Canadian Patriot. It's about 30 minutes talking about a gist of what's in your book. And because the audience may not know what it is yet, it's just it's fairly new. Let's begin with the basics. We'll go into specifics later. But what are the general fundamental points in your book that you focus on regarding the birth of international fascism, secret societies like the Freemasons, and their influence in Anglo-American foreign policy?
Well, the book is volume one of what will be a two-volume series. And volume one is more of the, you know, basics, but we're seriously lacking in our understanding of the basics. So it's still quite fundamental of how fascism originated in the 20th century as a geopolitical entity, and how fascism never actually lost World War II, how it entered institutions, and how its policies actually were implemented right after World War II ended. Volume two is going to focus more on the occult aspects, the secret society, the more kind of I guess you could say, for some people, the more exciting kind of stories. But I felt that volume one is really important, especially for the timing of today, because so many people are not aware of the true story of how much fascism was being promoted by players that we consider today as being anti-fascist, and how certain policies were put forward that were under the guise of democratic orientation, when in fact it was fascist, and it was being supported by people like Mussolini and Hitler and the fascists in from the Vichy government in France and so forth. And it was just given a kind of new veneer and resold, repackaged, but it was the exact same plan. And that was what was implemented after World War II and is the reason why we are in a situation that we're in today. So the book starts off with how British fascism came about and Kalergi's role, who is a prominent Austrian, who was basically the trumpeter. Richard Coudenhove Kalergi was the trumpeter of pan-Europeanism, which was again a very key element to the kind of fascist world order viewpoint, which is also what kind of basically spearheaded the formation of the European Union. And then we go on to how the CIA entered into this, that it was fascist as well from the very get-go with Alan Dulles and Foster Dulles's brother, who was in control of the foreign policy of the Eisenhower administration. I go through the Ukrainian situation too, how the CIA basically took Mykola Lebed, who was part of the Stepan Bandera branch who worked with the Nazis, and that this was given by the CIA basically prominence to pump in this kind of propaganda into Ukraine, this revisionist history, to radicalize them as a weapon against the Soviet Union. I talk about Gladio, which is actually something I want to focus on today, because I think that that's especially relevant, because Gladio played one of its main things that it was doing was interfering in elections within Europe, especially to support fascist right wing, but it also had paramilitary operations. So it was responsible for assassinations and terrorist attacks on the citizens of Europe under the guise of communist terrorism. This has been recently recognized pretty much at the beginning of the 21st century, but still not a lot of people are aware of the operation Gladio, the existence of this. And then I go into the implications of Nazis in the Middle East and how terrorism in the Middle East is actually an offshoot of this fascist element. And I go through the financial structures with the City of London. And then I end with James Burnham, the father of neoconservatism in the United States, how he was a Trotskyist, you know, right-hand man, but in fact, he was trained in Britain. You'll see Britain plays a very prominent role in organizing a lot of this. And he was trained by a Jesuit, I keep forgetting his name, at Balliol College. And that was pretty much, he was pretty much working for British intelligence the entire time. Even when he was supposedly working for Trotsky, he later on promoted Italian fascism and then became the spiritual father of neoconservatism.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Why is it important in your mind, Cynthia, to identify who, what, when, where, and why fascism comes from? I mean, and also too, when we say fascism is like, you know, conservative or far right, whatnot, how do you think that really affects maybe a lot of conservatives in the state who feel that what their form of their ideology of politics, which is a merger of, you know, religion, I believe, Christianity, of good, how do you think that affects them too as well when we identify all the above?
So fascism is, yeah, it's a very confused, I think, there's a confused understanding of fascism. If you look again at how it was being oriented, it really is fundamentally an imperialist concept to an extreme degree. And it has elements of the whole blood and soil, you know, component as well. Like, for instance, Oswald Mosley, who I'm sure most people know from Peaky Blinders, a really prominent pro-fascist in Britain, who actually was working with, you know, people like Churchill, were actually supportive of him. Just, you know, it wasn't so out in the open, but there's a lot of evidence that I put forward in my book. Stephen Durrell also did excellent work in his book on Oswald Mosley and the Black Shirts. But, you know, he makes the point, and this is not just his view. This is Kalergi's view as well. This is pretty much all of the view for this New World Order, really under the League of Nations banner. The United Nations was taken over to, again, support this League of Nations concept. It wasn't originally meant to be that, which is that you have six regionalizations in the world, which, and it was supposed to be a revival of empire, essentially, because the empire pretty much, all of the empires pretty much went extinct after the First World War. They collapsed upon themselves because they couldn't sustain themselves. And the League of Nations was basically a reboot of imperialism. And a huge component of this, like especially for Europe, was to view all of Africa as the labor, the massive plantation for Europe. And that Arabia too was going to fit in as a kind of slave colony as well. And this idea that, you know, whatever your ethnicity is, you should be living in the region in which your ethnicity has, you know, where you originated from. And so there was a lot of overlap with this fascist ideology. I think people get really confused because the Mussolini and even the Nazis were calling themselves National Socialists. But I go over this in the book as well. There was already a plan, and Georges Sorel plays a big role in this, of revising Marxism. I'm not saying Marxism in its original form was great either, but he was revising Marxism with the explicit intention, he had a huge influence on the Italian fascists, to infiltrate socialism and turn it into a fascist appendage, basically. So you will see, like, even Kalergi, who's a very clear fascist, a Christian fascist, he called his pan-Europe a crusade for the pan-Europe. You know, he was organizing the Vatican. He knew who the Pope was going to be before the Pope, Pope Pius XII, became the Pope. This was the Pope who didn't criticize fascist Italy when he was Pope. The previous Pope was very critical, and Kalergi never discussed anything with him. So he it seems like he knew who the next Pope was going to be, because that's who he was meeting with, Cardinal Pacelli, for like 5 years or more before he became Pope, selling him this pan-Europe idea. But Kalergi was meeting with fascists, but he was also meeting with Marxists and the Second International, Bakunin, Prince Kropotkin. There's all of this overlap, Trotsky, even there's all of this overlap where these components were also in support of fascism. Then you had communists who were fighting fascists, and there was a lot of betrayal of those communists. So for instance, you had communists in Italy who were very instrumental in defeating Mussolini. And that was one of the reasons why the French Church Senate Committee, this is the really famous committee that was put together to investigate the corruption of the CIA. They had concluded that the OPC rogue branch of the CIA under Frank Wisner and Alan Dulles was specifically set up as a paramilitary section of the secret army of NATO. One of the priorities was to intervene in elections in Europe, and the Italian election was the first one. It was a very big deal. And so they had successfully intervened in this election, which was certainly going to vote in the communists in favor of the Christian Democrats, who actually had many, many fascists within this party. And then you had the Years of Lead, which maybe some viewers are aware of, that was basically over 20 years of terrorist attacks on the Italian people to make sure that they never went, so-called left-leaning, meaning that they weren't going to support the communists. And in Greece as well, you had the communists who heroically fought the fascist Italians, and then the Nazis had come in, and they were fighting side by side with Britain, the Greeks, until Churchill in 1943 decided, well, it looks like you guys are going to win, and I can't have a communist Greece. So he reinstated the fascist monarch, and Britain made it clear that they were always going to be in support of monarchy. This is an essential component, Hitler and Mussolini too, you always support the monarchy. And they started to wage war against the Greeks. And this is what started the Truman Doctrine, because the Americans eventually were brought in. And the Truman Doctrine was what opened the floodgates for the United States to invade. It was the first country they went into, Greece, with this justification to fight the communists. They waged chemical warfare on the Greeks for fighting the fascists, pretty much. Like this is the ugly history that a lot of us aren't aware of.
In this mini 30-minute film that you guys put out on the Canadian Patriots called The Origins of America's Secret Police, you talk about how the cult of Delphi, which had its foundations in Greece, influenced much of the Western secret societies, particularly the ones that I want to point out are the Freemasons, which then had their influence through J. Edgar Hoover, Albert Pike, and other the Scottish Rite as well. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, what was their purpose? How did they get their claws inside U.S. foreign policy? And what was their actual intent in doing so?
Well, the documentary is, for me, the focus on making that documentary, which I don't actually go through the Freemasons in detail with this volume, is basically to get at the method. Because I know that a lot of people, they're interested in the names, and they want to see justice done by holding those individuals accountable. But I think that one of the big reasons why we're in the situation we are today is that we tend not to recognize the system, which continues to repeat itself, but it can call itself a different name. It can play on semantics and everything. And so the purpose of this documentary was actually to put light more on how these types of secret societies, it's an old game. It goes back to ancient Greece in terms of these kinds of manipulations. I go through how, the probably a lot of people again are aware of an element of this from the movie 300, where it was normal for the generals, the kings and so forth to have to go to the Temple of Delphi. They would let out their strategy, you know, like this is what I have planned out to have victory or to gain power or whatever. And then they would seek favor to the gods. But in reality, what was happening was that you had people from all over, not just Greece. You had, you know, also Persians involved in this as well. And further, they were all saying their plans to this one, you know, temple of priests. And then these priests could then decide who they would want to prop up in terms of helping that person's strategy succeed and whom they would want to sabotage. And so that was really the lesson for this, and how people who put too much importance in the secret societies who kind of get seduced by that. At the end of the day, you know, you're going to be sacrificed on that block as well. You're not, you know, above, and to think that you can have shortcuts to this kind of absolute power. And then there's this other danger of the average person looking at this as if it's some kind of true power. It's true that you had the Scottish Rite that played a big role in the formation of, you know, what the FBI was going to become. Really, it was to highlight that there was already a kind of soft coup, you could say, in the United States with Teddy Roosevelt's presidency. This is when the excuse for the formation of the FBI came in place. And Teddy Roosevelt was really, again, working for British interests. And so, again, it's just to highlight that you had this kind of nefarious thing from the very beginning. And the FBI, again, was playing this game of the Red Scare. They were using the excuse, even as early, you know, as the 1920s, to terrorize Americans with the justification that it needed to happen in order to, you know, make sure that you didn't have any kind of communist contamination. And that's the sort of thing that we ended up seeing later on with McCarthyism, COINTELPRO, and it has continued on, you know, to this day. In terms of like the next book, I'll talk a little bit more in terms of like the Freemasonic elements. You know, you have, it's like a really big topic that will also mm-hmm. like, you know, cross over Aleister Crowley networks and stuff like that. But I think it is a little bit too big to talk about, considering I do want to kind of focus a little bit on Gladio. But yeah, it's not as powerful as people think. It's really, you have to recognize the method. And then it's very easily seen for something actually quite pathetic for the most part. It's the people who put importance into that, they become dangerous because they put importance into it. But it in of itself isn't anything. Well, actually, I wanted to make a point because for when I was going over the communists, I forgot to bring up the origination of NATO, which is actually, it's a really big deal. Okay. That in France, they also had the communists that they were trying to boot out. And you had the Plan Bleu, which was supposed to be a takeover of the French government in 1947. And this ended up getting exposed. But instead of having a clean house, like cleaning of the house, what happened was that this secret army was then turned into what was called Rose des Vents, which is Rose of the Winds. It's also called Compass Rose. And this is essentially, this anti-communist secret army was essentially what formed NATO 2 years later. And that's where NATO got its Compass Rose insignia, was from this grouping. And so, just to, again, try to make it clear for people, when World War II was supposedly won, you had the fascists, you had Nazis who were put into these paramilitary cells all throughout Europe, but also, you know, in the Middle East and South America, to basically wage terrorist acts and so forth, paramilitary actions, in order to slowly move governments internationally all towards a fascist support base to, again, support this idea of a League of Nations. So I think it's really important for us to look at the incredibly long trend. The Frank Church Committee said it was 20 years of the OPC branch, which later was the deputy of plans for the CIA, intervening in elections, you know, doing assassinations. Today, you have David Ignatius, you know, when the Soviet Union was dissolved in 1991, he wrote an article basically saying that paramilitary activities of the CIA now should be out in the open. And you have, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is basically a continuation of Gladio type work that's going on in Russia, China, you know, the color revolutions in Ukraine, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. They all happened in the same year, in 2014. People have to really, you know, be aware that the National Endowment for Democracy is causing a lot of problems that is, again, just a continuation of this sort of stuff. So to just act like all of this sort of stuff is, like, you know, genuine is really naive at this point.
Fam, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, specifically, though, about Operation Gladio, what specifics do you think are most prevalent today? Like you mentioned, obviously we can see the results in supporting these, you know, terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, funding them and then crying about when they commit these crimes. Same with the Azov Battalion in Ukraine. And of course, all of these groups that are US funded right now. What do you see that, because you say, you know, these agencies change forms. Initially, you had the FBI, then you had the creation of the CIA. So is that how these societies have sort of morphed from one agency to another? Or is it like, you know, multiple ones? Like, who is it really? Is the FBI just basically an extension for the domestic side that the CIA and the NED and NATO pretty much occupy foreign-wise?
They're all working on the same team. Like they're not really distinguishable from the other, especially at this point. I'm not saying the CIA was always like all bad or everyone in the FBI. For instance, like the war on drugs, there were people who really did want to combat drugs within the DEA, but the reality of the situation was that the people that were in control of the more important top-down actions within the DEA, FBI, CIA. I go over the book, the heroin situation as well. They were always controlled by these fascist quarters. NATO was the Central European Command was led by a former Nazi for 16 years straight for NATO. So it's not like I don't really see them as separate institutions. There's an interesting quote maybe that might I think that people should also be aware of, that again has a lot of overlap with what I believe is happening today in terms of just constantly blaming it on, you know, a foreign entity, and we're not really realizing that there's a really big problem from within. Guérin Serac was he was a part of the French intelligence. French intelligence had many different branches. He was part of the OAS, which, you know, became the Gladio arm, and he was one of the instrumental players in this. And he did a manual called Our Political Activity. He writes, "Our belief is that the first phase of political activity ought to be to create the conditions favoring the installation of chaos in all of the regime's structures. In our view, the first move we should make is to destroy the structure of the democratic state under the cover of communist and pro-Soviet activities. Moreover, we have people who have infiltrated these groups. Daniel Gantzer, he wrote NATO Secret Armies. This is considered one of the authoritative books on this that documents this quote and, you know, much else extensively. It's pretty much not denied. Like, that sounds like a crazy quote, but it's a legitimate thing that is now pretty much recognized, but not a lot of people are talking about this. In terms of the Middle East, you had Otto Skorzeny, who is also a very big influencer of how Gladio was to be organized, and British intelligence basically created the formation of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was largely stationed in Egypt. You had King Farouk of Egypt, who was also pretty much, you know, doing Britain's bidding. And then Otto Skorzeny goes to Egypt, and he starts to train the Egyptian army, but he's also training, you know, other armies within the Middle East. And it's the book goes through like a lot of subjects, so it's kind of hard. I hope it's not too incoherent or too much for people, but it's a lot to try to explain, because each chapter kind of specializes in an element of the story, but it's not like one story that's just continuing with the same players constantly. But basically, yes, this idea of using terrorism to basically make the excuse to remove civil liberties, to get your own way, and then oftentimes you're causing confusion because you don't quite know who is backing whom. But this idea of blaming the communists is a really old game, and when you look at what the historical outcome has been in the 20th century, it has been the Anglo-American foreign policy that has intervened in democratic institutions. The Gladio is also tied with the Kennedy assassination, which I go over in the book. There is no other institution or agency, you can say, that has infiltrated, you know, what would have been a natural course, in my opinion, of economic partnership and cooperation. So much of like what we see as problems that have originated, including even Ukraine, right? The CIA was in charge of actually radicalizing Ukraine. Aerodynamic is the operation that they used using Mykola Lebed type propaganda for decades in Ukraine to specifically make them, you know, promote neo-Nazism as if that was something to their benefit. Nothing is like has originated pretty much naturally. Even like when we talk about the kinds of domestic terrorism that has become an issue, like in terms of shootings and things or bombings, we see that the FBI has actually had a hand in almost every case of like setting up the situation, or a lot of these people have actually gone through the MKUltra program and then gone on to do a lot of these types of terrorist acts. So it's quite astounding if you were to think what kind of world we would live in if we had not had this ongoing intervention, which, funny enough, it constantly says that they do it for our own safety and security from the communists, which we're always told are going to do the worst things to us. Well, you know, I think that the Anglo-American branch has already done the worst, and people really need to hold them accountable.
Yeah. I've said if China and America were two children, I'd tell America to go in its room. They're not having dinner, and lock the door. And I'd have a little conversation with China and just let them know, we're going to keep an eye on you, you know, but thank you so much. Move along. But yet nobody wants to hold our foreign policy, our empire accountable. Fam, do you have any more questions before we do dive into China or pertaining to what the history?
Long time we've been talking about Kennedy. A lot of people have been obviously questioning his assassination, which I think has no question at this point, but particularly because Dulles was in charge. At that point, it was like, you know, criminals investigating criminals. There wasn't like a real investigation, save one person. But in terms of that's important because people are always wondering who controls the United States, right? We always say here the national security state apparatus, the military industrial complex, these covert agencies, they're really in control. Joe Biden is clearly not in charge when we talk about foreign policy and such things. So my last question to you regarding this part of the subject is, who is in charge? I mean, in the United States, it seems to me that these agencies remain in charge. And it seems to me that they are taking us down a road that is extremely dangerous in terms of nuclear catastrophe, in trying to salvage a clear change that we're seeing from a unilateral world towards a multipolar world, at least an attempt at it. Do you think that these agencies have real opposition? Because in terms of when we talk about, for example, the globalist, the Great Reset, a lot of people sometimes think, well, everybody's all in charge, they're all part of the same things, this is all theater. Do you think there are actual opposition to these agencies in other parts?
Yes, there's for sure opposition, but it's very divided, and they don't seem to agree on the source of the problem. And again, what I would suggest to people is that you don't look for like the names, and hopefully, you know, we will be in a position where we can have a trial to hold at least some people, some big names accountable. But it's really the system, because it's run in a certain way that even if you were to remove certain individuals, the system is going to continue. And that's the real problem here, is that it's gotten so bad, unfortunately, for the United States and many European countries. Canada also is no exception. We don't have a democracy in Canada either. Where there does need to be an overhaul of the system. There, like, I mean, Trump has also, I think, seen it. Kennedy wanted to remove the CIA, because the CIA was never supposed to have any kind of paramilitary role originally anyway. They were supposed to be, it was supposed to be a desk job. And so Kennedy wanted to bring them back to that kind of a status. At this point, I think that you would have to go even further than that. The rot is just so deep that you would have to, you know, remake a lot of the institutions the way that they were supposed to be done. And again, that's so much damage occurred. You know, the FBI originates before World War II, but a lot of the damage occurred after World War II, because that's when the real takeover happened from within the United States, where, you know, British foreign policy again really took over. And for people who think that sounds insane, the NSC 75 was signed by the United States by Truman just a few years after World War II, and the Iron Curtain was announced because it was declared necessary to defend the British colonial interests internationally. The United States had to put this as the number one priority in order to combat Soviet communism. So that was like the line, that we had to keep other countries under colonial subjugation, because if we left them alone, well, then the communists would just come in and they would take over. And that was the excuse used. And that's why the United States, the CIA, were in so many countries that they were not supposed to be, including Greece, was to just, you know, continue the colonial interests. It wasn't to say that there wasn't resistance to this. Roosevelt actually was a really big resistance to this. It's unfortunate that so many people are confused about that element of his. And I go through this quite a bit in my book. I think I make a very good case of how all of the fascists pretty much hated Roosevelt. J.P. Morgan tried to, you know, organize a coup against him. And Keynes had his own version of the New Deal. And Keynes even said that, you know, he was pro-fascist, that his system would work best in a totalitarian system. And the reason why he called it the New Deal was to take it away from what Roosevelt was working towards. Again, the United Nations under Roosevelt had a completely different idea, but Roosevelt died 2 weeks before the first United Nations conference. And there were very key things that were decided at that first conference that ended up, you know, totally defining what the United Nations was to be. And unfortunately, the people present at that conference were not really aware or paying attention to what was going on. And it successfully was taken over to start implementing the League of Nations type concepts. So it was, you know, basically defending a kind of colonial outlook, which it was never supposed to have. So people just have to realize that it's these kind of system orientations are what are the problem. When you can see that, then you can see, well, who is resisting this, and what are the solutions to this? I would say, again, like Lincoln and Roosevelt were doing a very good job with their economic policies. I think that and Kennedy was also on the right path too, very clearly anti-imperialist in his outlook for the United States and the world. And these things just have to be studied and looked at. That's where the solution lies. And then we can recognize who our true partners are in this, in the sense of who is opposing this kind of thing on an international stage. And Russia and China are very clearly opposing this. This is why there is such a clear war drive that is happening from the Anglo-America specifically against Russia and China, and why you have the National Endowment for Democracy all over China right now.
Yeah. Well, let me just ask a question really quick, just so our viewers and everybody else can out there can understand, because I think sometimes it's hard to, especially in America nowadays, to take a position against something, because automatically the team sports mentality means, well, if you're against this, this means you're advocating for this. Just because you're talking against fascism or corporatism and all these other ways, and maybe even I haven't heard the word capitalism coming out, you're not necessarily advocating for communism, are you, Cynthia?
No. No, I'm not advocating for communism. And I don't really see China as defined by a purely Marxist outlook either. China's also very influenced, by the way, from Confucianism. China has a very old, rich history, which they didn't just like throw out, like how a lot of people think that you have to kind of get rid of all of the history before you became a communist state. China does everything in their own kind of, you can say, flavor or whatever. And they still very much have this ancient, centuries-old kind of perspective on the world and identity. It's in their philosophical teachings as well. You can see within the leadership of China, they very much put forward Confucius-type teachings. And, you know, Russia clearly is also, it's not a communist country. I think that actually the United States, the founding principles of the United States are a very good role model. And I do see China and Russia are in alignment with those founding principles of the United States. Basically, you know, the economic orientation that I'm for is an orientation where you think that the individual, you regard the individual as a sacred thing within your society that has a potential for the greatest good, and that we should have a society that is built on nurturing that, and not this outlook of, you know, a kind of Brave New World outlook, or that, you know, some people are naturally to be slaves, or a Yuval Harari type look of so many useless eaters and this sort of thing. Yeah. These are highly problematic views, which actually China does not have that view of their citizenry either. They don't consider their citizens, even though they have so many, as being mostly made up of useless eaters. So that, again, it's an imperial outlook, that when you look at most of your population as a problem, that you actually even promote depopulation, which again, euthanasia is being promoted here in the West. Euthanasia is not being promoted in China.